If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin Underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorn. In today's episode, we'll be delving into the murky history of murder with the lawyer and writer Kate Morgan. Kate is the author of a new book, Murder, the Biography, which explores the legal history of homicide and some of the cases that have contributed to UK murder law as we know it today. From Richard Parker, the cannibalised cabin boy who was eaten by his hungry crewmates, to Ruth Ellis, the last woman to be hanged in the United Kingdom. Kate spoke to BBC History Revealed editor Charlotte Hodgman.
Kate, thanks so much for joining us today. Perhaps you could just start off by telling us a little bit about the book, you know, why you wanted to write it and, you know, how you went about it.
Yeah, of course. Well, the inspiration for the book really, from my point of view, came from being a lawyer by background, and as well as that, being a bit of a true crime fan as well. And I think when you watch all these documentaries and dramas, you know, we get very taken in with the crime and what happens. But it just got me thinking about actually how much do I know about the law that sits behind all of this, the law of murder. I could recall bits and bobs from when I studied the subject at university, but really not an awful lot. So I started to look into that. And as I sort of dug out the textbooks and started to read up on some of the cases, I realised that there was this really sort of compelling mishmash of these, you know, very, very tragic, but also very interesting and fascinating stories that were really as exciting and as dramatic as anything that you see in television or film. And I just started to think, I think there's possibly a book in there. I'm a big nonfiction reader, so I always thought that if I did have a book in me, it was probably going to be nonfiction. And being a lawyer, writing what you know, the law seemed the obvious place to start. And that's really, it went from there, basically.
Okay. I mean, it's interesting that you say that you're a true crime fan. I think that's something that kind of has struck me, is that, you know, we seem to have, you know, a big fascination with murder and crimes and this topic. Why do you think that is? Why do you think we're so obsessed with that type of thing?
It's such a good question, and I still don't know, having written a book about it. I think it's very true. You know, we talk about true crime, but what we really mean is murder when we talk about that. That's what we're ultimately really fascinated with. And what struck me as I was researching and looking at some of the cases that make up the book is actually our current obsession with, you know, Netflix and docudramas, all that kind of thing, podcasts as well, obviously. It's nothing new. When I was going back through some of the older cases, particularly from the Victorian era, where you've got essentially the growth of the popular press then, everybody's always been fascinated with these kinds of stories. So I don't think at the moment it's anything new. I think it's some really intrinsic dark part of human nature. And I think that there's something there, you know, going back to the days of public executions a couple of hundred years ago. We used to crowd the streets and watch people be executed, which you wouldn't dream of doing that now. But I think it just shows that there's this really dark element and sort of fascination with these grisly things that's just an intrinsic part of human nature.
Yeah. I mean, would you say that the Victorian era was sort of the golden age of kind of our fascination with murder? Was this kind of when we can see that it kind of peaked?
I don't think it peaked then, but I think it sort of hit a high point then that it's not really come down from. There's a really interesting short essay by George Orwell called The Decline of the English Murder, and he dates the decline of classical murder to around the turn of the century, but I don't think that's true at all. I think it was really just getting into its stride then. I think what happened in the Victorian era is there's this birth of the tabloid press. There are things like the penny dreadfuls and the broadsides. So suddenly crime and murder and horrible things happening to other people becomes very accessible, and people do want to read about it, and then they can. So suddenly then there's an almost an industry there from the newspapers, and then dramatists as well. What I found really interesting when I was looking at a lot of cases from the 19th century is, things like the television adaptations and the dramas that we have nowadays. I mean, there's been recently the programme about Dennis Nielsen starring David Tennant. There was White House Farm on the television. I think that was last year. That's actually nothing new, this making drama out of murder. You know, there were some 19th century cases in the book that as I was researching, found they'd been turned into plays. They've been turned into sort of ballads and broadsheets and all that kind of thing. So I think there's almost a perfect storm in the 19th century of it becomes immediately accessible to people. And that coincides with everybody discovering this grisly appetite for entertainment based on these horrible stories.
Yeah. I mean, your book looks at kind of the murder as a crime, doesn't it, in general, and the sort of different types of murder. I mean, when just sort of going back to the very beginning, when do we first start using the word murder? You know, what does it mean, and where does that word actually come from?
It goes back a lot further than I thought, but perhaps not as far as other people think, because we get a bit obsessed, I think, with thou shalt not kill, and we think it's a biblical invention, essentially, which to some extent it is. But what we actually call the crime of murder in this country is a bit more recent than that. Really, that comes into play in the sort of Anglo-Saxon era, where it first becomes something that is punishable by the state and punishable by death. So in around the 10th and 11th centuries, there's this concept of Mordor that emerges into the legal system. It comes across from France and also from Germany. And what that denotes is a secret killing. So it's not just the fact that you've killed somebody that makes it a crime. It's the fact that you've done it in secret is what makes the law take an interest in it effectively. And then over the next couple of hundred years, that got finessed a little bit. It got anglicised, and that then led into the crime of murder that has been part of the law since those times, really. But what has changed over the centuries and continues to change is the types of killing and the circumstances of killing that falls within that definition of murder. So I talk in the book that, you know, all murders are homicides, but not all homicides are murders. And there's been an ongoing challenge for the law, really, to draw those demarcation lines between the kinds of killings that it deems to be murder. And that's shifted almost continuously since back in those Anglo-Saxon days, really.
So in the Anglo-Saxon period, was it a lot more was it simpler than it is today? So you took somebody's life, that's murder. You know, that's whereas today perhaps the definitions are slightly more blurred,
yeah,
aren't they?
So to begin with, essentially, I mean, there was a lot of circumstances that it wasn't, a killing wasn't even treated as being unlawful. I mean, it was, I think we, you know, in the modern era, we kind of forget how dangerous daily life was back in those days. And actually violent death at somebody else's hands wasn't necessarily the shocking thing that we see it as today, because life expectancy was so much lower. There were so many other threats to people's safety that actually the act of murder wasn't really given the prominence that it is in our culture today. So at that point, it would only be those secret killings that were effectively treated as murder back in those days. And then it's as the law progresses probably over the next few hundred years. So by the sort of 15th and 16th century, it's come to be attached with this concept of sort of premeditation and malice aforethought that really defines murder from other lesser homicides like manslaughter.
Mm. And what sentence would a murder carry in that Anglo-Saxon period?
Yep. So in certainly from like the Middle Ages onwards, it would be death for those killings that were found to be deliberate. Originally, before the concept of Mordor entered the law, very often the killing was atoned for by paying something known as bot, which was effectively financial compensation to the victim of the person that had been killed. And that then was the end of the matter, really, as far as the law was concerned. So it didn't become a crime that was punishable by the state until this concept of Mordor and then murder emerged a couple of centuries later. And really ever since then, murder has been punishable by death in almost all circumstances. What did change over the course of sort of more recent history is the fact that there were so many other crimes that were punishable by death as well. When you get into the 17th and particularly the 18th centuries, there were almost 200 criminal offences that were punishable by death. So murder really wasn't anything special. You know, you could be hung for stealing a loaf of bread just in the same way that you could be hung for murdering someone. It's only in the middle of the Victorian era where the death penalty for crimes other than murder and treason is abolished that murder sort of assumes this prominence within the criminal law, based largely on the fact that it is the only crime in effect punishable by death. And I think that gives it an extra layer of notoriety from that point onwards.
So what changed? What made, you just said that, you know, that there were many crimes that kind of had the death penalty. Was there a particular case or was there anything that you can sort of, we can pinpoint and say, this is when and this is why murder began to sort of be taken very seriously?
I didn't find anything specific, but I think what happened was in the Georgian era, there's a lot of focus on the law as being a means of protecting property and money and finance, and somebody interfering with those rights was seen, you know, as no better than a murderer, and that was reflected in the punishment of the law. And I think as society progresses and the law gets a little bit more enlightened, that seems to drop away, really. So that certainly by the 1820s, 30s, that there's beginning to be the stirrings of an abolition movement for the death penalty in general anyway. So that sort of adds on the pressure for the law to slim it down and really focus on which crimes should be punishable by death, and that progresses throughout the Victorian era. So it's very difficult to point to a sort of big bang theory. I think there's just a gradual realization that this is not a civilized way for a legal system to conduct itself. And I certainly found notes in reports of cases from that era that were very critical of that said, you know, that the death sentences handed out by British courts were not acceptable, and it was something that the country should be ashamed of. So I think the reaction and the opposition to the death penalty, which you know went on for several hundred years in effect till it was got rid of it only in the middle of the 20th century, that's had a very long history to it as well.
Okay. What about manslaughter? Does that have as long a history in legal terms as murder?
It does. I mean, they sort of they grow up alongside each other, really, because as murder becomes defined, then there's a question of then setting the boundaries of crimes that fall short of that, and to what extent should the law punish those. So manslaughter as a term enters the lexicon in about the 1500s. I think that's the first recorded instance of it. It really hits its stride in the Georgian era with the habit of the aristocracy of settling their arguments with duels, and the reluctance of the courts to criminalise gentlemen and people of the higher social standing to criminalise them for murder. So the courts then began to take a more expansive approach and try and find reasons to be able to reduce that charge to manslaughter. And that's where a lot of the defences that we still use in courts today come from. So, for instance, provocation, the idea that somebody can provoke you into killing them and that will reduce the crime from murder to manslaughter. That dates from this sort of 16th and 17th century era of the duel, and that was the reason that was given to be able to reduce that crime to manslaughter. But I think that there's a lot of commentary, even in 20th century manslaughter trials, about how difficult manslaughter can be as a concept. In some ways, it's a lot more difficult to categorise than murder because it covers so many different circumstances and so many different types of killers. It ranges from something that is in effect all but murderous to something that's practically accidental. So there's a very rich history, and in some ways the lore and the stories connected with manslaughter are equally as fascinating as the murder trials as well.
Yeah. I mean, you know, as well as the crimes they commit, people are also kind of fascinated with the people who are doing the killing. I mean, you know, what makes a killer? I mean, what is there anything that links these perpetrators of these crimes that you can sort of see?
Yeah, I think the common factor is there is no common factor. Basically, is what I found as I was looking at the book, and that's part of the process I went through in researching the book that I found really interesting, because I'd studied some of these cases and stories when I'd done my law degree some years ago. But you don't at that stage, you don't go into the human stories. You just look at the case on a very surface level to look at the point of law that comes out of it. So what I was really interested in with the book is getting into the detail of not just the deaths of these people, but also their lives and the circumstances that surrounded them. I think the fact is we have a very very black and white concept of what a murderer is. It's very bound up with what we see on the television and in film. It's a shadowy stranger. It's Jack the Ripper. It's that kind of thing. But actually, when you look at the lore and the stories, that is very much not the case. You know, most of them, a lot of the cases that I cover in the book, they come from desperate circumstances and something that goes horribly awry. And what I found is that the people that the law classes as a murderer are actually in a lot of cases very far removed from that image, and it's not anywhere near as black and white as we would imagine.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
I remember reading a really powerful account of the days before Ruth Ellis's execution. People were gathered outside the prison where she was being held, and they were chanting Evans, Bentley, Ellis. So these cases, I think, had got tied together in the public's imagination. So I think the concern from the government at that point was if they didn't go ahead with executing Ruth Ellis, they might as well abolish the death penalty there and then, really.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin Underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing that struck me when I was looking at some of the cases that you look at. On the one hand, you've got, you know, you've got serial killers, and then you've got, there's a case that you mention in 1884 about the three sailors who ate the, yep, the ship's boy. I don't know whether you can tell us a little bit more about that case as well. It's quite an interesting story. But I mean, but they're both, in theory, they're both termed as, they're all termed as murderers, aren't they? They're all labelled with the same...
Exactly. I think that's part of the problem for the law, is it's almost too blunt an instrument now, because you know, you've got, on the one hand, somebody who's very deliberately and very cold-bloodedly killed somebody within the parameters of the law as it stands today, somebody who has not planned a killing in advance, but does kill somebody either intentionally or with the intent to cause them serious harm, they are guilty of murder. That's the composition of the criminal offence. So there's a lot of argument around whether that's actually the correct approach, because it doesn't differentiate between the circumstances that somebody can end up taking a life in. And the case you mentioned there is a great story, and it's one that when I've been talking about the book, people seem to really pick up on, actually. It's the story of Thomas Dudley and Edward Stevens, who were the captain and mate of a small sailing yacht called the Mignonette. And in 1884, they, along with another crew member and a cabin boy, a young lad named Richard Parker, they were hired to sail the yacht from Southampton down to Australia. They hit a storm in the middle of the Atlantic and were shipwrecked. They just about managed to get into a lifeboat before the yacht sank. So you're left with the four of them about 600 miles or so from the nearest land in an open boat in the middle of the Atlantic, surrounded by sharks and rain and burning sun and everything. It was really a horrendous set of circumstances for them. After about a month, they have managed to survive on a few tins of turnips and drinking rainwater and eating a turtle at one point, I think, but they decide that's no longer enough. So poor Richard Parker, the cabin boy, is obviously the youngest, and he's also the weakest of them. He's been drinking seawater and he's not very well at all. So there comes a point when Dudley and Stevens decide to slit Parker's throat, and they eat his flesh in the lifeboat, and thinking it will probably prolong but not necessarily save their lives. But just a couple of days later, by really fortunate circumstances, they're picked up by a passing ship who rescues them from the lifeboat, noting the presence of some bones and bits of meaty looking stuff in the bottom of the keel. And the ship takes them to Falmouth, where they're brought back ashore. And when they go into the customs office to tell the customs officer about what happened, they're quite upfront about what they've done, because from their point of view as sailors, they don't think there's anything wrong with it. At that point in history, people thought that cannibalism at sea was acceptable in circumstances that it could help somebody's survival. So they thought they'd just simply done what any other sailor would have done in those circumstances. The authorities obviously didn't agree, and they decided to arrest them and put them on trial for murder. What I found fascinating when I was reading about the story is that there was a huge amount of public sympathy for them. Even Richard Parker's family were quite happy to shake their hands in court when they saw them, because they generally felt that they'd done what anybody else would in those circumstances. But as far as the courts were concerned, they couldn't rely on an argument that killing somebody to survive was a defence to murder. The court said that was not the case. What they'd done was murder, and they were convicted. Fortunately for them, they weren't executed. They were reprieved by the Home Secretary and Queen Victoria. So they just served 6 months in prison rather than the death penalty. But it's a case that still crops up occasionally today when people talk about whether there's any such thing as a defence of necessity to murder. It all dates back to Dudley and Stevens, which said absolutely no, there is not. And I just found it fascinating with that case because I don't think that's very well known now. And I just think it's such a great story. And it was a huge splash at the time, but we seem to have forgotten about it because I think they're not... they're not a Jack the Ripper or something like that. They're very human individuals in a very dreadful situation. And I think with that one, it sort of begs the question, well, would you have done the same thing if you were in that boat as well? And I think that goes to the heart of this idea of whether our perception of what a murderer is actually borne out by the reality of it.
Yeah, no, that is, I mean, it is a great story, definitely. I mean, are there any sort of other kind of key cases that you came across that you think have been perhaps instrumental in perhaps shaping, our understanding of murder in the law?
One of the ones that I was really interested to read about was the story of Ruth Ellis, who's obviously very, very well known. You know, a lot of people will know her story. She was the last woman to be executed in Britain. She was executed for the murder of her boyfriend, David Blakely, in 1955. And she's gone down in history really because she was the last woman to be executed in this country. And that was about the sum total of what I knew about Ruth Ellis. I didn't really know the ins and outs of her story and her trial, other than it's always presented very much as a crime of passion. She, you know, had fallen out with David, had then tracked him down after a tiff and had shot him outside a pub in Hampstead. And it's always presented as this quite sort of film noirish femme fatale story, really, like something out of crime fiction. But what I was really interested when I was researching that one was to see that about five or six years before Ruth Ellis's case, there'd been another murder trial involving a young lady called Renee Duffy, who was from Manchester. And she'd killed her husband with an axe after an argument, and had also, as Ruth Ellis would go on to do, had tried to argue that she'd been provoked into murdering him because of his ill treatment of her, and she was unsuccessful. She was convicted of murder, and at her trial, the judge set out the test of provocation, the legal test of provocation, around words and deeds by the deceased person to the accused that has caused them to lose their self-control. So that became the test that Ruth Ellis then had to satisfy when she argued for provocation just a few years later. But what really astonished me with that story was the discrepancy in the public treatment and the authorities' treatment of the two women. Renee Duffy was convicted of murder, but she attracted an enormous amount of public sympathy, and she was actually reprieved, so she was not executed. For whatever reason, Ruth Ellis didn't seem to attract that same sort of warm feeling and sympathy from the courts and also the government then when the question of a reprieve came up, and she then obviously was to go down in history because she was executed. So I just found it really extraordinary to read about the difference in approaches and the difference in reactions for what were really two quite similar cases, you know, both involving women who'd killed their partners in quite trying circumstances. But you know, one is reprieved and we don't really know that much about her unless you're a criminal lawyer who happens to look up the history of the provocation defence. The other isn't reprieved and she goes down in history and we still talk about her today. So I just found that was a surprising bit of the Ruth Ellis story that I didn't really know that much about.
No, I mean, do you have any theories as to why that might have been?
The best I could find when I was looking at the case was, I think by the time that Ruth Ellis comes to trial in the mid-50s, there's a bit of a maelstrom going on around the death penalty. There's been the case of Derek Bentley a couple of years before, which I also talk about in the book. Bentley was a young lad who, with one of his friends, went out to rob a warehouse in London. His friend, a lad named Christopher Craig, shot and killed a policeman during the course of the robbery. They were both both prosecuted for murder, and Bentley they were both convicted, but Bentley was old enough to face the death penalty. He was 18. So he was executed, whereas Craig was under 18 and wasn't executed. So there'd been a lot of controversy around that. There'd also been the execution of Timothy Evans for a murder at Rillington Place in 1950, which actually turned out to be the responsibility of John Christie, who was then found a couple of years later to be a serial killer in effect. So there was a lot of public controversy about those executions, and people were questioning whether the death penalty itself should be brought to an end. I remember reading a really powerful account of the days before Ruth Ellis's execution. People were gathered outside the prison where she was being held, and they were chanting Evans and Bentley Ellis. So these cases, I think, had got tied together in the public's imagination. So I think the concern from the government at that point was if they didn't go ahead with executing Ruth Ellis, they might as well abolish the death penalty there and then, really, because I think they thought that would be opening the floodgates to full-blown abolition at that stage, and they didn't want to do that.
Right. Yeah, that's an interesting point. Another thing that kind of interests me is the whole concept of diminished responsibility, particularly kind of mental health and when do we first sort of see people perhaps their crime has been classed as manslaughter, perhaps more over murder on the grounds that they were kind of not of sound mind. When do you sort of first see that sort of coming about?
It's quite a drawn out history to that kind of element of homicide, actually, because you've generally, as far back as it's possible to go, if somebody is considered to be insane, it's generally very difficult to convict them of a crime, because to be guilty of the crime, they have to have a guilty mind. They have to have the mental intention to commit the crime. And if you are not of sound mind, you cannot have formed that intention. So insanity as a defence goes back a very long, long way. It didn't really crop up in many well-documented cases until the sort of late 18th, early 19th century, when we get really good records of trials and transcripts, and obviously medical evidence begins to become more sophisticated at that point. So you start to see it really set out more thoroughly. So there's a case in the book from the late 1700s, a Scottish case involving an aristocrat who shot and killed his brother, a chap called Archibald Kinloch, who was put on trial for murder in Edinburgh in the late 1700s. And he was found to be guilty but insane, and the courts were then prepared to have him discharged to medical care rather than executed. And that case is an interesting one, because there's quite a lot of first-hand testimony about the impact of his mental illness and the suffering that he went through and how that culminated in what he did. So that's a sort of early bellwether for things beginning to change. Then through the 19th century, medicine, and particularly psychiatric medicine, begins to become more sophisticated. In the mid 19th century, there's a famous case of Daniel McNaughton, who is a disgruntled carpenter from Scotland who believes the Tories have got a grudge against him, which culminates in him coming down to London and shooting who he thinks is Robert Peel, the Prime Minister, but who actually turns out to be Peel's secretary, a man called Edward Drummond. So McNaughton was tried for Drummond's murder and was found to be insane. And as part of the sort of fallout from that case, the House of Lords looked at the circumstances of McNaughton's insanity and set out what's now known as the McNaughton Rules, which is the test that the courts apply to determine whether someone is insane and therefore should be acquitted on that basis. So there's a few other cases around the same time involving assassinations. There's a couple of attempts on George III's life and also Queen Victoria. And a lot of these cases involve insanity defences. But it's a very binary concept in the law at that time. And it's, you know, in essence, if somebody understands what they've done and they understand that it is wrong, then to all intents and purposes, they are sane as far as the law is concerned. And there's no recognition of sort of other stresses or mental disturbances that might stop short of meeting that test, but could still drive somebody's behaviour and suggest that they shouldn't be responsible for their actions. So it's actually not until the 1950s that the concept of diminished responsibility comes into English law, which is a more subjective assessment of mental illness and the extent to which that should be taken into account to reduce something to manslaughter. So that only comes about in the 1950s, really, and it's quite controversial at the time. I think these kind of cases always are, actually, because I think particularly if there's been a very brutal or apparently wicked crime, I think people get very hung up on somebody trying to almost take an easy way out with an insanity plea. And actually, there's some quite poignant testimony, certainly in some of the Victorian cases, where people are pleading insanity, where their lawyers are saying, look, you know, this is not an easy way out. Mental health care at the time was such that actually being found to be insane and confined to an asylum for a lot of people would be a fate worse than death.
Another thing that I found really interesting was the idea of corporate manslaughter, which is quite a modern sort of concept. And it kind of made me think that obviously the law is going to have to constantly change, because this is a brand new, you know. When did we first sort of see a company being kind of convicted of manslaughter? Clearly that would have been quite a landmark moment sort of legally.
Oh, it's a great question, actually. It was the bit I was really interested to weave into the book, because when I was a lawyer, I worked as an in-house lawyer, so I did a lot of sort of corporate regulatory law and stuff like that. So it's the kind of thing I was really interested in. And I had this preconception that the concept of corporate manslaughter is a really modern one, that it goes back to this really tragic period in sort of the late 80s and early 90s, where there was this sort of slew of public disasters with huge loss of life in Britain. There were things like the Marchioness sinking in the Thames, and the King's Cross station fire, and sinking the Herald of Free Enterprise ferry on the crossing from Zeebrugge. That all happened in quite a short space of time with high casualty numbers, and people really felt that it wasn't sufficient to hold individuals accountable, that, you know, the circumstances of these tragedies really required corporate accountability for what had happened. What I was surprised to find when I was researching the book is the concept of corporate accountability for homicide is older than I had first thought. There's actually a case in the 1920s involving a young boy in Wales who was electrocuted by a perimeter fence at a colliery, and his family tried to prosecute the coal company for his death unsuccessfully, and they said that because homicide has the idea of personal violence at its heart, that you can't make a company guilty of that. And so nobody tried again for 60 odd years then, and until the Herald of Free Enterprise catastrophe, which was a ferry that was on the crossing of the channel from Zeebrugge back to Dover, when that sank in the late 1980s. The outcry was such that people wanted to see action brought against P&O, the ferry company. And it was attempted. There was a case brought against both the directors of P&O, but also the company itself for manslaughter. It's not possible to prosecute a company for murder, because a key element of that is that the person who's who's committed the offence has to have a guilty mind. They have to have intended to kill somebody to make them guilty of murder. And obviously companies don't have minds. They're non-human entities. They can't have that. So any conviction for homicide could only be for manslaughter. And it rested really on being able to prove that sufficiently senior people at the company had in effect committed the offence of manslaughter. And in the P&O case, the court decided that they hadn't. There couldn't be this link made between the upper echelons of the management and the board and what had actually happened to the people on the ferry. So the prosecution was thrown out of court and collapsed. And then it wasn't until 2007 when the government actually brought in a specific piece of legislation to make corporate homicide and corporate manslaughter a specific criminal offence. That was the first time that it had been properly addressed in English law. So I think the impact of that new offence has been fairly muted to date, really. There haven't been any big cases of prosecutions of big companies for fatalities, really. So I think what will be interesting to see in the coming years is how that plays out in the context of things like the Grenfell Tower disaster, and whether the law of corporate manslaughter that we've got on the statute books now is really sufficient to bring companies and organisations to book for a big tragedy like that. So I think there will be some interesting developments in this area of the law in the next few years.
That was Kate Morgan. Kate's book, Murder, the Biography, is on sale now, published by Mudlark. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman and Brittany Colley. Join us tomorrow when Larry Loftus will be sharing the story of a World War II spy.